Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m., rain or shine, and glad to have you with us. And tell a friend about the show, because we tend to follow the money here, and that's very true today. Going to be talking with benefits expert John Elliott about a variety of things, pre-retirement counseling, what you should know, whatever age you are in the government, and take a look at Medicare, too. So, John, thank you for being with us today.
Good morning, Mike.
John was like the most valuable player in the HR business when he was in government. He was with the OPM. He was with the DEA, briefly with agriculture. You were with customs, and people kept drafting you and pulling you away. So it's good to have you here with us today. And we got a couple of questions from people. By the way, our number here, if you want to call and talk directly to me or to John, our number is 202-465-465. 3080. That's 465-3080. But we got a couple of email questions from people. Maybe we can dispatch with those. This one, I think even I know the answer to this. It's from Teresa Kay, and she says, I'm 50 years old with 23 and a half years service, although I'm attempting to return to the U.S. government to get my full CSRS pension when eligible. I'm interested in the long-term care insurance now before premiums are too far out of reach. Can a former federal worker qualify and purchase long-term care? And the answer is yes and no, right? They can get it somewhere, but not with the government.
Well, yes, that's right. He'd have to return to the government. Now, retirees, if you don't have if you want the federal long-term care, as a retiree, you can pick it up at any time. But otherwise, you'd need to be an active federal employee. Now, if he has a relative, like a spouse or a parent, well, he's 50 years old, so he probably doesn't have a parent working for the government.
Yeah.
But, you know, he could get it that way. So
yeah.
I forget how far the relative definition goes down. I know you can insure a parent.
Yeah.
I assume a parent can insure a adult child. But certainly a spouse. So he might have a federal spouse and he could get it that way. But I'm guessing if he asks the question, he probably doesn't. Otherwise, but if you want LTC insurance, you can still get it privately. Now, I was eligible for the federal plan when it first came about in 2002. I was a federal employee. But I got it. I compared the federal premiums and coverage to private, and I ended up going private. Both my wife and I went private, and are still with the same company years later. And we got it. I was 57, and she was 51 at the time. So the premiums were reasonable. We've only gotten one rate hike in the 12 years we've been with the company. And it's a substantial company. It's an insurance company you've all heard of. Yeah. I'm not going to give them an endorsement because they're not paying me.
Mm-hmm.
But I am for sale.
And just, you can be had.
I can be bought.
Yeah.
But you don't pay, you don't get an endorsement. But it's been fine. So I would encourage you to go that route, because since that's your only avenue.
Right, and younger is better than older.
And younger at 50, you should be able to get a reasonable premium,
that's about
for sure. Now, for the rest of you, or when this person does return to federal service, there's a website for this, ltcfeds.com, and they have a handy calculator where you can plug in the type of coverage you want, and there's various amounts, and it'll shoot out a and your age and so forth, and it shoots you out a premium, and then you can take that and compare it with what you could get in the private sector.
One reason we're talking about long-term care insurance too is if you read today's federal report, the long-term care premiums went up effective August 1, and that's for people who are buying it on or after August 1. So they did not go up if you currently have a policy and got it before that date, your premiums aren't going up. But the average increase is 30%, so that tells you something about the high cost of long-term care. And an interesting situation, my mother was a long-time government worker. She got long-term care, as you did, outside of the government. And when she became very ill there at the last, between Social Security, her civil service annuity, and long-term care insurance, we, the family, were in very good shape. It was that's kind of a gift to your kids, long-term care insurance.
It absolutely is, and that's one of the reasons we both got it. We do have two adult children, and it's just, it's something that one thing less they would have to worry about if one or both of us ever needs long-term care. Plus, if you have a long-term care policy, the likelihood is that you will get in a better facility.
Yes.
Or a better situation within a facility if you have, as opposed to relying on Medicaid.
Absolutely.
Now, millions and millions of people in this country are in long-term care and rely on Medicaid. And I've had at least a couple relatives who were in Medicaid homes, and they were fine. One was in Austin, Texas, and the other relative was in rural Wisconsin. And I have heard that if you're the rural areas, I realize Austin's a fairly big city, but the rural areas, you tend to get better care even if you're on Medicaid. It really doesn't matter. Oftentimes, the caregivers are from the community. They may know you or... And so they had positive experiences.
But all things being equal,
but
long-term care.
But if you get in some of these urban areas, you would be glad if you had long-term care insurance.
I'm kind of the poster boy for long-term care insurance because I got mine years ago. I was quite young to have it. Got it through the Washington Post, and it was a group plan. Well, the company that offered it to hundreds of us no longer does it. They dropped it. Now they kept us. We've been grandfathered in, so we're in good shape. And it's like as you said, it's a very good company. But like many back when I got long-term care insurance, there were something like 20 or 25 companies that offered it. Now I think it's down to about six. And you see from this 30% premium increase that long-term care is a very expensive proposition. And the beauty of the federal program, and you can get this in the private sector too, is that you can buy inflation protection. And I looked at the government chart yesterday, and you can buy 4% or 5% inflation. And that's very helpful.
Yeah, but you can do that in the private plans too. I have 5%.
Well, they didn't have it when I bought it.
Yeah. I've got 5%.
We've got a really good basic question here, and then if we can go to something other than Medicare. This is from Rachel, and she says, "Hi, my spouse works for the government. Question, I don't understand why it would make sense to pay for Medicare Part B no matter how sick we are. Wouldn't the cost of the premiums be greater than the cost of the copay and deductions that it would cover? As far as I can understand, it seems that it would be sensible to continue with the federal government insurance, skip the Medicare, and use the money we would have spent on the premiums to cover our copays. Some years we might come out ahead if we aren't too sick, but as long as there's a maximum out of pocket, we can't lose."
I love this question. Mm-hmm. She's exactly right. Mm-hmm. She's really using her head. I'll just use myself as an example. I'm a federal retiree, but when I turned 65, I could have signed up for A and B Medicare. I could have signed up for C and D, but forget C and D for federal employees. That's probably, so we're going to focus on A and B. Now, the Part A, what she wants to do when she turns 65 and her husband turns 65 is sign up for Part A, because you've already paid for that out of your payroll taxes. So that, at least going forward, is free. So you want to do that, and a combination of Part A and your federal employee plan should mean you'd have no out-of-pocket hospital expenses except for prescription drugs, and your prescription drugs through your federal health plan, or depending on which plan you have, are discounted to varying degrees. So that's what you want to do. The easiest way to do it, and I did it, I just, at 65 or approaching 65, I just signed up online. You could go into a Social Security district office, but why bother? If you just go to medicare.gov and sign up, which as I did, very simple, took me a couple of minutes. Bow, B is our question. To be or not to be is the question. Now, B, of course, is not free. Currently, the monthly premium is $104.90 per month per person. There's no family plan like there is the federal plan, so it's per person. And that premium goes up the more money you make. So you get the low premium if you're single and earn from all sources, pensions, investments. Your income is $85,000 or less a year, or $170,000 if you're a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're married and your income exceeds $170,000 per year, you pay a higher premium, and it goes up and up and up. So I think for the next level, it jumps from $104.90 to $140-something.
Yeah.
Well, and it remains static for several years. When I was 65, the premiums were higher. And I looked at it.
They've actually gone down, the Medicare premium?
Yes, okay. And they've remained static for a couple, two or three years.
Let me ask you for a minute. We have to take a break here, but I'll get back to you on that. Be right here, back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with John Elliott. He's a benefits expert on all things federal. He was with a number of federal agencies over the years, had a long career in government, and he appears frequently on the National Institute of Transition Planning show for your benefit.
Well, not as frequently as I used to.
Okay, well.
Occasionally.
You have been on the show.
I have been on the show.
Okay.
Many times, years ago.
Before we took the break, you were talking about Medicare, and we got a really good letter from someone, as you said, Rachel, who did her homework.
Yeah.
And she says that in her case, it doesn't make sense to pay the Medicare Part B premium, that they'll save the money and then use that in case they need it to pay off bills.
Well, she's done very good, and she has very good analytical skills, so I mean, she's like me. I mean, and if she follows through with this, and I would recommend that she does, in that if you're in good health and you're a relatively low consumer of medical services, now Part B, I should have mentioned, covers your doctor's expenses, outpatient fees, lab costs, that thing. But obviously the main driver of your Part B premium is doctor's fees. So if Rachel is like me and she's an infrequent consumer of medical services, doesn't run into the doctor all the time, Part B is not worth it. I mean, it just doesn't make good sense.
Okay, now that assumes that you take the money you would have spent on the premiums.
Well, even if you don't, you can spend it frivolously if you want.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're
still going to have your federal health benefit plan, which is going to cover, depending on which plan you have, mm-hmm. is going to cover most of your expenses. So it's not like, you're without coverage.
Okay, well, flip
far
it. What
from
a,
it.
What about who should have Medicare Part B? I mean, anybody?
People who have health issues
mm-hmm.
that are a high consumer of medical care, run into the doctor all the time, whether for legitimately or you're a hypochondriac, and or have maybe not currently sick, but have potential health issues.
Family history,
I would look at your weight.
Mm-hmm.
We all know if you're overweight, significantly or maybe not so significantly, that can, mean you're headed for some dangerous health issues.
Smoke 2 packs a day.
Oh, smoking. Yeah. Forget. If you're a smoker,
mm-hmm.
sign up for Part B.
Okay.
If you're if you're a heavy drinker, you might want to sign up for Part B. Look at your family history, your own behavior. If you don't exercise at all, walk, which is exercise, of course, and very good exercise. If you don't do any of that, if you're sitting on the couch, you probably want to take Part B, because you may not be sick now, but chances are, if that's your lifestyle, you're playing kind of Russian roulette with your health. I mean, there's no absolutes here, but I would tend to favor taking Part B.
Now, if you do take Part B, and I don't want to step on your presentation, but if you do take Part B, you've said something about that makes a difference in the sort of federal health plan you select, correct?
Yes. If you do take Part B, it eliminates all out-of-pocket medical expenses, again, except for prescription drugs, but they're usually pretty well discounted through your federal plan anyway. That's why almost no federal employee with a federal health plan needs Part D, the drug part of Medicare, unless you'd be a heavy, heavy user of drugs. I'm talking about legal prescription drugs, of course. If you're a heavy user of illegal drugs, you might want to take Part B as well. But at any rate, those are the candidates for Part B. I have a good friend who's a federal retiree who has Part B, and he has virtually, and I only say virtually is because of the drugs, because he takes a lot of prescriptions, about 11 pills a day or something. Yeah. And he's not in a life-threatening condition. He's in his early 80s, but he's a good candidate for Part B, because he's seen the doctors for various non-life-threatening issues over the years, and currently he's had back problems, and I forget all the problems he's had, but he's a perfect candidate, and he's glad he took Part B because it eliminates his out-of-pocket expenses. The other thing you can do is, taking a Part B oftentimes allows you to pick a cheaper FEHB plan. So if you're in Blue Cross Standard, for example, chances are you could go to the cheaper Blue Cross Basic with a combination of Part A and B Medicare. Now, if you don't take Part B, I should mention that by regulation, your federal plan can only pay the Medicare-approved amounts. So this kind of scares some people because they hear that. But, again, if you're in good health, you leave a reasonably healthy lifestyle. And I'm not talking about you have to be an exercise fanatic. But you can, like me, and maybe like Rachel, you don't need Part B. You know, when I, at 65... if I had taken Part B, I would have paid about $2,000 a year. Now I'd pay maybe $1,700 a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I go to the doctor, and maybe this is true of Rachel, once a year for a physical. And I don't even pay a copay for my physical. And if I did, it would only be $20. But my plan, they say, hey, he's getting a physical. That's good for us. I pay no out-of-pocket for my physical because of my federal plan, and that's about it, once a year. So what am I getting for my $1,700 a year? Absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I get sick, let's say I get a cancer diagnosis down the road, I can still sign up for Part B. Yes, I pay 10%. Surcharge for each year I delayed past 65. But even with that, if I got a serious illness, it would pay for me to maybe sign up for Part B. Even with the 10%, I'm 69, so I'd pay 40% more if tomorrow I got a cancer diagnosis, or some, or they found out, unbeknownst to my doctor, that I somehow had a heart condition or something. But I can still get it, albeit with the increase in the surcharges.
Okay.
10% a year. So if I ever need it, and the cost wouldn't be prohibitive. So if I ever need it, I can still get it. So that's another area of security or comfort.
Okay.
For people like Rachel and I who choose not to take Part B when we're eligible.
Okay, some non-Medicare issues, because you do these retirement seminars. You've been doing them for years. When they always say you should start retirement planning as early as possible. You agree with that?
Well, sure, because with the federal government, of course, you're coming in under the Federal Employees Retirement System, or FERS, and your retirement security is heavily dependent on the Thrift Savings Plan. The sooner you start that, we hope, as soon as you get employed, you should start contributing to the federal plan, TSP, Thrift Savings Plan.
And get that max.
At least 5% of your salary to get the maximum government contribution. But do as much as you can. There are annual limits every year. I think this year it's up to $18,000. If I'm off by $500, forgive me, but that's close enough. And if you can do it, and eventually probably will be able to do the max, you should do it. But the key is, do it as soon as you possibly can. Because if you just delay 5 years, say, well, I'm only 25, I can wait. Well, let's say you finally start at age 30. You will notice a huge difference, and I should have brought figures. I used to present these figures in my seminar. I calculated on the TSP calculator. But it's almost sickening, that five-year delay.
Yeah.
Say you could have invested for 30, 35 years as opposed to 30, 25 or 30 years. It's a huge difference.
Yeah.
It'll make you sick.
Yeah, the miracle
and
of compounding.
And how do you figure that out for yourself? Well, at tsp.gov, they have a calculator, and absolutely go use the calculator and compare. Well, if I invest for 25 years or I invest for 30 years, you'll see the difference, and you'll be shocked.
Yeah.
If that doesn't get you in it right away, nothing will.
Nothing will. Got to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with John Elliott. He's a benefits expert who's worked with the National Institutes of Transition Planning. He's also a frequent guest on their show, or used to be a frequent guest on their show, but frequent guest, we hope, on this show from now on. John, when we took the break, you were talking about one of the most important things for retirement planning is to start early and get into the Thrift Savings Plan on day one if you can. Get in there and get that 5% match by putting in 5% of your own money and the value of compounding.
Yeah, and a few years ago they started, because enough people weren't signing up right away, they put them in it automatically and put them in the Super Safe G Fund. Now I think they put them in the appropriate L Fund, and we can get into L Funds if you want, what those are. And it's based on your age. But you can opt out. Of course, you can opt out at any time, but if you don't like the automatic setup thing, you can say, take me out.
Well, that's one thing where Big Brother is doing a good thing for you.
Absolutely. They're doing you a huge favor. Yeah. And if you were, a grouch or skeptical, you can pull out if you have to or you want to. And I realize some people do have some hardship and maybe not be able to invest right away or whatever.
You know, but, ask you about the different funds. Some years ago, I went around to all of the young people in the organization I was with. I was just curious because we had a 401k, nowhere near as generous as the government plan. It didn't have any employer match, but it was still a 401k plan. And hardly any of them even knew what they were in. They were right. in something,
right.
but they didn't know. And now the government, you know, some people complain the choices, they're not enough. Some people say there's a bewildering array, but you've got a big stock fund, a small cap stock fund, an international stock fund, a bond fund, a treasury securities fund, and then you mentioned the L funds. What are those?
The L fund uses all five funds, the three stocks and the two bond funds, and it's based on your age. The younger you are, now, I should back off a little bit, not back off, but explain that you can choose any of the five L funds you want. There are five of them, and they're based on your age. But what young people should be doing is picking the L fund that has the highest percentage in investment in the three stock funds and a relatively small portion in the bond funds.
Right, because they've got 10, 20, 30 years to
yeah,
grow.
They've got, and well, typically 30, 40 years
yeah.
because let's say you leave the government, you don't have to take your money out of the TSP. You can leave it in there to continue to grow. You can't contribute to it, but it'll still grow depending on the performance of the investments. But the young people should be heavily into stocks to the tune of 80, 85%.
Because you have time
now,
to
now, what
the
L fund right. does, it's kind of for those people who just have no interest or patience with, you know, investing and following. And over time, let's say you're in the most stock-heavy L fund at the beginning, over time that L fund will become more and more conservative. Every quarter, I believe, a little bit would go into bonds, very tiny amount. But over time, at the end of the period of, say, 30 years or whatever it is, it will drop to almost all bonds without you doing anything, without you lifting a finger. Now, the downside of that is that just because you're getting older or just because you're retired, you're in your 50s, 60s, or I think the most conservative L fund, where you now might be, if you haven't done anything, is too conservative. Because if you retire in your 50s or even about 60, you might well live, and more of us are going to live till older and older ages, you might live another 30 years in retirement. So I would argue that you still should be, as I am, in about 50% stocks and 50% bonds. And I have, outside of the TSP, I haven't touched my TSP yet, but I have investments outside of the TSP, all in stocks. So I'm a kind of, now, if you're very risk averse and you couldn't sleep at night with that formula, fine.
So,
you know,
fine.
Be in the much more less fluctuating bond funds.
Well, many people, when they talk about these life cycle funds, and you just made the point, they say, well, I'm going to retire in X year. Well, that has nothing to do with it. It's when you're going to start tapping the money. That's
right.
Your end
Correct.
Date.
Correct.
So if you're not going to tap it until 2040 or 2050, that's the fund you should be in,
right.
Not when you're going to retire. The other point, too, is an awful lot of people agree with you. They think the life cycle funds are too conservative. And
well, they can get to that point as you're
Well, even 2020 fund compared to some others. But the board, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, the point they make, right or wrong, whether you agree or not, the point they make is that because of the federal annuity And because of the Social Security component, which a lot of people, particularly at retirement, don't have in the private sector, that the federal, they've designed the federal life cycle funds to intentionally be more conservative for that reason.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. But all I'm saying is just because you're in the L fund, you should, and it's kind of a no-brainer. And that's how it's designed to be. It's designed to be a no-brainer for people who just don't want to follow it. I would say still you want to follow it and make sure that the you're comfortable with the percentages of stocks versus bonds. So I was in L fund for a while, and but I got back. I still use all five funds, but I do
but
it on my own. I still do about 50% among the three stock funds, and the other 50% I do with the two bond funds on the recommendation of a financial planner that we use in our seminars. And because, and I think a lot of financial planners, probably most, if you have one or if you listen to one on the radio or TV, will tell you don't get conservative too early because you still might live many years into retirement.
Let me come back to that. We need to take a short break here, but come back to that. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with John Elliott, benefits expert, a longtime federal worker, now retired, but still in the business of advising people about retirement planning and whatnot. John, we were talking about the Thrift Savings Plan, and you made the point that the, probably the first thing anybody should do when they get in the government is start maxing out their contributions, that is, put in at least 5%, more if you can, but at least enough to get that 5% match from the government.
Yeah, that 5%, that's free money.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a tax-deferred pay raise every year. Yeah,
now, you can get into a Roth thrift savings plan as well, which was a development 5 or so years ago.
Right, and if you're young, that's a wonderful deal.
Yeah, so you can, well, it, you don't get the tax savings, but
going out,
you don't pay taxes on it.
So, I mean, if you have $1 million in it, you have $1 million.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another option you have that you didn't always have before, whatever.
Yeah, and again, if you're young, that's a gift from the gods.
Yeah, if you don't need the if you can do without the tax reduction, yeah, it's a good deal.
Yeah. Now, on back to the life cycle funds. These are, they're 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050, and this is the year that, or close to the year, when you think you'll start withdrawing the money from the TSP. For most feds or many feds, it's not the year you're going to retire. It's the year you're going to start using it, which can be very different. You've been retired for a long time. You still haven't touched your TSP.
So yeah, I've been retired, 13 years.
Okay, and you haven't touched it yet. So.
No, now, when I turned 70 and a half, the year I turned 70 and a half, I have to start taking minimum deductions, according to the IRS rules, 6 months. No, it's by April 1st of the year I turned 70 and a half.
But, you know, a lot of tax people, they say people make too much. It's not much money.
It isn't much money.
And B, you don't have to spend it. You can put it in the savings account. You can do, you can, you don't have to, I mean, people.
Yeah,
people
that's
like,
true.
It's
your money, but I haven't figured out, or we haven't figured out, my wife's a retired Fed as well, we both have thrift savings plan accounts. We haven't figured out what we're going to spend the money on. So we haven't touched our investments,
right, something
including the TSP.
But back to this thing about where some people think that the life cycle funds are too conservative. They have too much in bonds and the G fund in it.
Well, not initially.
Wouldn't a way around that be, say, technically, I should be in a 2020 fund, and I don't want to manage it. I don't have a financial advisor like you do. But what about getting into a 2030 fund?
We'll get into the fund. Like when L funds were created, whenever that was, I forget, but it was years ago. I got my age at the time, and I'm guessing I was probably in my 50s, said I should be in the 2020 fund, which I think beginning the 2020 fund, it was, as I recall, and I could be wrong, but 60, 65% stocks, and maybe it was as low as 50, whatever it was, but I didn't. I chose the more stock-heavy funds. In fact, at the time, it was the highest stock portfolio was the 2040, as I recall. I was in the 2040, which was more like 80% stocks and 20% bonds, as I recall. Because I was under the old CSRS system, so I felt I could afford to assume more risk.
Yeah, more generous annuity.
And I tend to be less risk averse than some other people. Mm-hmm. But certainly if you can't sleep at night, then, you know, be heavier into bonds if that makes you sleep better at night.
John, I know you said you don't do commercials for people, but I know you're a big fan of NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, and their magazine is just, to me, I am a NARF member, self-disclosure, I am a member of NARF, so I can get the magazine, you know. But what's your thoughts on that for people who are working and people who are retired?
You should be a member of NARF. And you can join online at NARF.org because they're the only organization dedicated to fighting for your benefits, both as an employee and as a retiree. And they've been very successful over the years of stalling or, in many cases, if not most, in most cases, preventing erosion of your federal pay and benefits. Not 100% by any means. I mean, these last few years have been pretty rough on federal employees, no question about that. I'd shudder to think if NARF weren't there, how much worse it could have been. The dues are almost free.
A joke.
It's like a few bucks a month. If you want, you can participate in your local chapter. If you don't want, fine. You don't have to go to meetings or anything like that. But you do get the monthly magazine as part of your membership, and that is chock full every month of good information. Each month's issue, they have a Q&A. Employees and retirees write in with a question, and the NARF folks answer it. And you can just read through the Q&As every month and learn a lot that you didn't know.
But then
they have also a lot of good articles, a lot of good advice, including things like advice if you're going to relocate after retirement.
Yeah, best cities to retire. Yeah,
best cities,
breaks, yeah.
Things you should consider, how you should approach relocation. You're just making a big mistake if you don't join.
Well, along that line, the thing that NARF and some other groups fear the most is something called the change CPI, and that would be changing the formula used to determine how big a cost of living adjustment retirees get each year in January. Now, under the current one there, it looks like they're not going to get a COLA in January of 2016. Still some time to go, but normally they get 1, 2, 3%.
Well, they get whatever the rise in the CPI
right.
is.
But this would change that, and this would take it down by, I think it's 0.4%, which doesn't sound like much, but over a period of years, Jessica Clement, the legislative director of NARF, I think she's figured that the average CSRS retiree would not get something like $38,000 over a lifetime.
Yeah, that's what the number crunchers say.
Yeah.
You know what? It's hard to predict. You can go broke predicting what any Congress will ever do. So I won't predict whether it's ever going to come to pass. And you realize that that chain CPI, if fully implemented, would affect Social Security recipients as well.
The third rail of American politics.
And because if you didn't include Social Security recipients, it would save bupkis almost. So it's a politically tough sell because everybody's going to be a Social Security recipient someday. And if you touch that, it's, as has been for years, called the third rail of politics. You may be looking for a new job if you're in Congress. So it's still problematical whether they'll have the fortitude to deal with it. There are other ways to save money with a Social Security issue. The big problem we have is the medical expenses, Medicare and medical expenses in this country. Social Security could be fixed, and it could be fixed without touching the COLA formula. I mean, it's the COLA formula is not the only way they could balance the books down the road.
No, but I mean, it's the one that the unions fear and
yes,
the,
it is.
And the administration endorsed
my point about joining NARF is they're fighting against that because it affects you as a federal employee, and of course it affects non-federal employees as well, if proposed. My big fear is they'll chicken out and only focus on federal employees.
Yeah.
That's a tiny, tiny part of the pop and retirees. That's a tiny part of the population. We'll save virtually no
nothing
money.
But
it's just making a statement.
It's a gesture.
It's a cowardly way out. And as we know, politicians are some of the most cowardly people in our society.
Good deal. With that, we're going to thank you very much, John Elliott, for being here. Thanks to Lauren Larson for running the show. Remember, we're on every Wednesday at 10 a.m. These shows are archived, so if you want to get, I think John's take on Medicare Part B is really interesting. You can listen anytime. We'll see you here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.